old. You're our prisoner, and you'll be tried as a southern spy." Roan was about to protest that he was no spy when the clip-clop of horse hooves silenced him. A rider was moving fast through the mist, his green cloak billowing behind him, his chestnut mare cutting a path through the white trees. He eased to a trot and then stopped completely when he reached their camp. "Ho, messenger," Gareth said, standing. "What news bring you?" The prince's men had already formed a staunch barrier around him. The rider wasted no time, remaining in his saddle as he delivered his news.
"I come from Rue, where we've just received tidings from Hammerton." His voice was slightly high-pitched.
"What say the barrel-chested men of the Smith village?" Gareth asked. The man threw back his hood, and Roan was surprised to find a young lady hidden beneath the cloak. Her hair so silver, Roan wouldn't have been surprised to learn it had once been struck by a moonbeam. Her lustrous locks curled around her pointed chin. Even more surprising was her attire, which was a complete set of polished silver armour. Moulded so finely, it appeared to have grown around her slender form, even forming intricate patterns beneath her mouth, along her delicate jawbone, and swirling past her strangely yellow eyes to her forehead. "She's as spectacular as the prince," Roan thought. "Maybe more so." "We received a stream from our spies in Castle Hill." The young woman paused to let the chain of information sink in. "They're saying the Dread King of the North is dead." For a moment, there was complete and utter silence in the forest. And then the men cheered.
5. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Anise Gerick. Her punishment had been cut short. More than that, her father's orders to flood the streets of Castle Hill with traitors' blood had been halted before it could be carried out. The death of a king had that sort of effect. Still, it felt odd to Anise that the death of one man could actually save numerous lives. The news had spread like an ice storm throughout the city, and Anise was certain it would swarm throughout the rest of the Four Kingdoms with equivalent speed, as streams were prepared and sent. Soon their enemies would know. They would gain strength from the news. "They will attack us," Anise said, with certainty. "Not right away," Art said. "They'll wait to see what transpires. Even then, our borders at Blackstone, Raiders Pass, and Darin are strong. We're safe in Castle Hill." Anise closed her eyes, trying to erase the images of the last several hours. Her father's unexpected appearance in the tower, his typical brutality, the ghostly apparition, and his sudden tumble down the tower steps. Numb with shock, she'd raced down the winding staircase, horrified at how slick the stone was with her father's blood. When she'd reached the bottom, one of the soldiers of the king's defence was in the process of covering what was left of the king's body with a sheet. But not before Anise had caught a glimpse of his face, which was bruised and blooded, his skull caved in, so different to the man she'd known her whole life, the man she'd feared and hated with every breath and beat of her heart. And when she'd seen him like that, so weak, so broken, she'd felt nothing but joy, which scared her a little. Then her brother had arrived, ushering her away to his quarters, where they'd been hunkering down ever since, sitting cross-legged on his bed across from each other, thick as thieves, the way they used to be as children. As Arch had cleaned the blood from her face from where their dead father had hit her, she'd told him everything the king had said to her, and what had transpired on the staircase afterwards, leaving no detail out. Well, except for the strange spirit who had appeared. The boy who she swore looked like a paler, weaker, younger version of her brother. Clearly, her eyes had played a nasty trick on her, and talk of ghosts would only cause her trouble. Plus, her brother was obviously not a ghost, even if he acted ghoulish sometimes. She'd also left out her mother's unexpected visit. She was still trying to make sense of it herself. Anise could almost feel her mother's arms around her, hear the echo of her whispered words in her mind. "I am proud of you." Stark realization hit Anise. "You're the king," she said with a gasp.
Yes,
Art said. There was no surprise in his voice, as if he'd known it from the moment he'd seen their father's corpse. That's when something else occurred to Anise. Her brother had lived his entire life with the knowledge that one day he would be king. That understanding had been his constant companion, hidden behind his easy, confident manner, his never-ending laughter and jokes, his adolescent nature.
"What will you do?"
Anise asked. Arch laughed, as if the question was an invitation to a party. "What I've been born to do. Rule. Protect the North. Improve the lives of our people."
"You will be a great king,"
Anise found herself saying, to her surprise. Even more surprising to her was how much she meant it. Despite their everyday childish bickering, she believed in her heart that Arch would be everything her father was not. Good, fair, honest, loved. A knock on the door made her flinch. The door creaked open, and their uncle, Lord Griswold, appeared. Something about his expression unnerved Anise. He almost looked refreshed, despite the fact that they'd all been awake for most of the night. His beard was freshly trimmed, his eyes bright and clear, his grey tunic pressed and adorned with the royal sigil. Sir Dietrich followed him in, offering a slight nod to Anise as he entered. The victor of the melee was even more handsome this close to her, despite the dented armour he continued to wear, despite his scarred face. She remembered the rest of his body. How many other scars were hidden beneath his armour? He took up a position in the corner, and she pretended not to sneak glances at him. On the opposite side of Lord Griswold was Sir Jonius, who stared straight ahead. Anise tried to catch his eye, to discern a glimpse of his usual kindness, but he only angled his head further away. It was the side where the topmost portion of his ear was missing, though Anise had never learned the story behind the old wound.
"You were out of your quarters last night," Sir Griswold said.
"I was in the tower," Anise said. "I was being punished."
"Not you," her uncle clarified. "Your brother. His chambermaid confirmed he'd left after nightfall."
"I couldn't sleep," Art said. "I went for a walk."
"Where?"
"Why are you asking him this?" Anise asked. Her uncle's voice was like ice.
"You will not speak unless spoken to," he said.
Anise opened her mouth to tell him that she was a princess of the North, that he was nothing but a lord, his authority akin to the brightness of the stars, while hers was as powerful as the sun. Arch placed a hand on her arm, sensing her anger.
"Anise, it's fine."
Turning back to their uncle, he said, "I went all around the castle. I stopped in the kitchen for a bite to eat. Went by the stables to brush Samson. Might have met a maiden or two for a tickle." Anise rolled her eyes. This was the brother she was more accustomed to. Not the man who was so certain he was the king now.
"Did you go to see your sister?"
Lord Griswold asked.
"No,"
Arch and Anise responded at the same time.
"My father came to see me," Anise said. "Not Arch. Nor a ghost that resembled him," she added in her head. "My mother, too, but you need not know that."
"Sir Junius said he saw you near the tower staircase," Griswold said to Arch.
Anise looked at Arch. Arch ignored her, his eyes never leaving his uncle's. Suddenly this entire conversation felt more like a trial than a series of information-seeking questions. "That doesn't mean anything," Arch said.
"What are you saying? You think Arch killed his own father?"
Anise couldn't believe the audacity of this man.
"I saw what happened. He fell. It was an accident. If you're going to accuse Arch, you might as well accuse me, too."
"I've spoken to Sir Craig. He said you were in the tower room the entire time, that he was guarding your door. You couldn't have seen or done anything."
"Damn that bloody drunken knight."
Anise didn't know if he was trying to protect her or his own reputation. And yet it was strange that the knight hadn't mentioned her mother's visit.
Curious. "Craig wasn't there. My father made him leave. And anyway, he's a drunk," she said. He probably saw the Celthron Empress in the halls tonight, too.
Silence!
Lord Griswold said, taking one step forward and backhanding Anise across the face. Her head snapped back, and she tumbled off the bed, shocked by the attack, which seemed to come out of nowhere. Her cheek felt hot, and something wet trickled from the corner of her mouth. Once again, she was bleeding. Like brother, apparently. Her father and uncle cut from the same brutal cloth. Arch was by her side in an instant.
"Sister, are you hurt?"
he asked, helping her to her feet. She glared at her uncle, refusing to cry, although her eyes were stinging.
"I barely felt it,"
she lied. Lord Griswold seemed to find this amusing.
"Get out,"
Arch said, pointing at the door. When Lord Griswold didn't move, Arch took a step forward and said,
"As your king, I command you to leave before I see fit to have you hauled to the dungeons."
Lord Griswold smirked.
"On the contrary, you are a murderer, and I'll have you in chains. You are hereby accused of killing my brother, King Wulfric Garrick, supreme ruler of the North, the Dread King, your own father. Apprehend him."
Sir Dietrich stepped forward, his hand moving automatically to his sword hilt.
"I'm afraid I can't do that, my lord," he said.
"Why not?"
Lord Griswold turned, anger flashing in his eyes.
"Because I am sworn to defend the king. That's him, not you."
"You were also sworn to defend my brother, which you failed miserably at. Prince Arch has not yet come of age, and thus I am his lawful regent for the time being."
"And yet not the king,"
Sir Dietrich said firmly. Anise wanted to hug him.
Well, first slap her uncle, and then hug Sir Dietrich.
"You've made your choice, then,"
Lord Griswold said.
"It was no choice," Sir Dietrich said.
"And yet the consequences will be the same."
He snapped his fingers, and a third figure slipped through the door, his finger already glowing blue. Sir Dietrich began to unsheathe his blade, but Sir Jonius quickly moved in position to secure his arms, while the Ice Lord touched the sword's hilt, which immediately froze, shattering into a dozen icy shards. The knight hissed as some of the magic seeped into his hand, turning it blue. He tried to lift it, but found he could not. His fingers wouldn't move either, as if struck with sudden paralysis.
"Stop it!"
Anise cried, rushing forward. Lord Griswold cut her off, grabbing her by the hair and slinging her to the side. She crashed into the bed's footboard, which cracked from the impact. She watched helplessly as her brother tried to intervene, but was held by the Ice Lord, who conjured chains of solid ice to bind him. Dozens of guards marched in, securing Arch and Sir Dietrich, escorting them from the room. Arch glanced back, and for the first time that Anise could remember, he looked scared. In this moment he wasn't a king, but a 16-year-old boy accused of murder. Sir Jonius pushed him into the corridor, still refusing to look at her. Before she could regain her feet, the door slammed behind them, the lock clicking with an ominous finality that left her slumped on the floor. All that remained of Sir Dietrich's sword was a puddle on the floor. Anise wondered if his hand would ever heal, or if it would remain dead and useless for the rest of his life. More than that, she wondered how long or short that life might be. Thinking about Sir Dietrich distracted her from thinking about Arch.
Murder? It was impossible,
regardless of the weird vision she'd had on the staircase. Her brother wasn't able to materialize and disappear like a spirit. He was as human as she was, flesh and blood and bone. Yes, that was it. Regardless of what drunk Craig said, she was the only witness, and she would attest to her father's death being an accident. He tripped and fell. That was all. But who would believe her? Her father was not a clumsy man. If anything, her denial of Arch's presence in the tower would only implicate her in his death. She was plenty strong enough to have come up behind him and pushed him down the stairs. For a moment she wondered why she hadn't thought of doing that herself. A knock on the door startled her away from her thoughts. She rolled off the bed, grabbing a large vase on her way to the door.
"Yes?" she said.
The door opened and a guard entered. She flung herself at him, bringing the vase down hard on his head. He cried out in surprise and pain, crashing into the wall. Her niece trampled over him on her way out, and he grunted from the impact. Two guards grabbed her arms, and though she managed to break loose from one of them and punch him in the jaw, a third guard appeared and subdued her kicking legs. They tackled her to the ground and dragged her back inside, throwing her on the bed.
"Enough!"
one of them shouted, and she realized it was Sejonius.
"You are only making this worse for yourself, princess."
His jet-black hair was disheveled from the tussle, and he was breathing heavily. Her lips curled in disgust. She hated Sejonius's two faces. She hated the man who always remembered her name day, giving her small gifts that were exceptionally thoughtful. She hated the man who followed orders without question. She hated the man who seemed to care with one breath and was as cold as an icy blade with the next.
"Where is my brother?"
"King Regent Griswold has Arch is the king.
He has yet to come of age, and he's been accused."
"I was there. I saw what happened. My oaf of a father tripped. It was an accident."
Anise realized she was gripping the sheet of her brother's bed so hard they'd begun to tear. Sejonius looked at her hands, then back at her face.
"Princess, please. There's nothing I can do." "There's nothing you will do. There's a difference."
She could see the pain her words had caused the knight, but she didn't care. He was nothing but a pawn. That's all he'd ever been. Another idea came to her.
"I want to see my mother."
"That's impossible."
"Why not? What have you done to her?"
Sejonius pursed his lips.
"Sejonius, it's me. It's Anise."
She remembered something he'd once called her when she was still little and her shape was considered cute.
"It's your snow angel."
"Forgive me," he said, ushering in a chambermaid. He left without another word, the other two guards hauling out the man Anise had knocked senseless.
"I'll never forgive you,"
Anise screamed, launching a pillow at the door just as it closed. The chambermaid caught the pillow with impressive reflexes.
"Oh, sorry," Anise said. "That wasn't meant for you."
She studied the chambermaid, who didn't look familiar. Perhaps her uncle had already sacked all the old servants and brought in new ones. Her face was covered with a shawl, only her dark eyes and smooth, pale forehead visible. A few locks of brown hair curled from her brow. She was a solid-looking woman, not unlike Anise's own shape, with broad shoulders, a small chest, and a wide stance. She was decidedly pear-shaped. She carried a tray with breakfast: two poached and peppered eggs, buttered toast sprinkled with cinnamon, a shiny red apple, and a jug of milk, which she set on the foot of the bed in front of Anise.
"What is your name?"
Anise asked.
"You don't recognize your own flesh,"
the woman answered, her voice stern and deep. The voice was familiar, but Anise hadn't heard it in years.
"Aunt Zelda,"
she said in disbelief. The woman removed the shawl and promptly popped one of the eggs into her mouth, struggling to chew. Anise shook her head. She was still coming to terms with seeing her aunt twice in as many days, an event as rare as finding an ice bear that laid eggs.
"What are you doing here?"
Anise asked, pulling the tray back as her aunt attempted to snatch another egg. Zelda eyed the tray with narrowed eyes.
"Your mother sent me."
"Mother?"
Anise said, frowning. As far as she knew, her mother had never even spoken to Aunt Zelda. The two were as different as summer and winter. Then again, she'd noticed the look they shared at the tourney, the way they'd slipped away, almost synchronized.
"When did you speak to my mother? Where is she? Why won't they let me see her?"
Zelda reached for a piece of toast, but Anise swatted her hand away. If she wasn't careful, her aunt would force her to go hungry.
"Your mother and I have been friends for a long time," she said. "Secret friends."
Anise was surprised, but she didn't let it show. her aunt continued.
Queen Lorraine.
Annice noticed how she used her mother's maiden name.
Is locked in the dungeons, like your brother.
Nothing made sense. Surely neither her father nor uncle would have incarcerated the Queen just for missing the end of the tourney. Plus, she'd just seen her mother earlier that night, and though she acted a little strange, she wasn't in chains.
Why? She's being accused of high treason,
Zelda said, pulling an apple from a hidden pocket and crunching loudly.
What treason?
Annice forgot about her breakfast for a moment, and Zelda took advantage of her lapse to snag the other egg and take a bite. Her aunt raised an eyebrow.
Why, the murder of the king, of course. That's impossible. She had nothing to do with it.
Annice was aware of the way her voice was rising, but she felt powerless to stop it.
Of course she didn't. Her plan to murder your father was to be executed in a week's time.
Zelda finished both the egg and the apple, while Annice struggled to form a coherent response.
You mean she was planning to murder him?
Annice finally said, her appetite gone. She relinquished control of the cinnamon toast.
Try to keep up, dear, Zelda said. Your mother was planning to poison him. There is evidence of her attempts to procure darkweed from a most sinister character of the northern black market. Of course I was in on it, too, although they'll never link me to the attempted crime.
Though she hated to think of her mother in the cold, dark dungeons, it could only mean one thing.
Then Arch is innocent. They have to release him.
Her aunt tusked.
You are so young, child. I'm nearly 18,
Annice protested.
I'm a grown woman. In body, yes, but not in experience. Your mother is accused of attempted murder, while Arch of actual murder. Your uncle is saying they both wanted your father dead, but Arch just happened to follow through first. That's a lie. Of course it is, dear, but the evidence will be stacked heavily against him. But I'll have to testify. I know the truth. The truth is a snake of many colours, dear. It can change depending on who is charming it. No, the truth is the truth.
Zelda polished off the toast and waved her words away.
Listen closely. Whatever happens, you must not draw attention to yourself. Be ready.
With that, Zelda covered her face with the shawl, snatched up the empty tray, and left amidst Anise's protests for her to stay. The wooden execution block had long ago been stained crimson by the blood of those who dared defy the dread king. Anise wrapped her arms around herself, her breath misting in the frigid air. She searched the royal viewing box for her aunt, but she was notably absent. The rest of the space was filled by Lord Griswold, his son Dirk, the Ice Lord, and several members of the king's defence, including Sejonius. Earlier that day, Sejonius had once again entered Arch's room, this time to collect Annice. He refused to look at her or answer her questions. Eventually, she'd given up and allowed herself to be escorted to the box where she now stood, waiting for something horrible to happen. The commoners stirred as soldiers marched onto the platform. In the midst of them was Queen Sabria Lorraine Gehrig, guarded by swords as if she might fling herself away at any moment. In that moment, Annice believed her mother had never looked more beautiful or prouder. Despite the fact that her blonde hair had lost its luster and hung in knotted vines around her face, despite the smudges of dirt and cinder on her typically pristine white dress, despite the swords aimed at her heart and throat, despite the way the commoners jeered and booed her, as a foreigner with clear disdain for the North, she'd never gained their love, she held her chin high, her expression one of fearlessness. In that moment, Annice loved her, and wished for her mother's love more than anything. It was an impossible wish, she knew, but then she remembered all that had transpired the night before. Her mother's words to her, the affection in her voice, the regret.
Then why, mother?
have you always looked at me with such anger? Why did you hate me for all these years? Why do you refuse, even now, to notice me? Mother,
Anise whispered under her breath. Her uncle must have heard her, because he grabbed her arm.
A traitor is the mother of rotten bones and dung. She is not your mother any more. You have no mother.
Anise twisted away from him and said nothing, watching as Queen Garrick was led to a small ladder that ascended to a wooden platform. Above her hung a noose tied to a scaffolding.
Anise wanted to cry out, to plunge herself from the box and onto the platform, to fight through the guards, let them try to stop her, and rescue her mother from this farce of a trial.
But her aunt's words from early that morning stopped her.
Whatever happens, you must not draw attention to yourself. Be ready.
As if sensing her restlessness, her uncle motioned to two guards who moved to either side of her, blocking her in.
Frozen hell, Anise thought. I've already drawn too much attention.
On the deck, the soldiers stepped aside to allow the executioner to pass. He wore a long, hooded black cloak, boots, and gloves. The hood hung over his forehead, casting his face in shadow. He was a large man, more than capable of moving the platform out from under her mother's feet. Slowly, ominously, he climbed the ladder. Sabria Loren ignored him, staring straight ahead, even as he fitted the noose around her neck.
"Where is the trial?" Anise wondered frantically. "Where is the evidence and the witnesses for and against her? This cannot stand. I won't let it. I won't—"
"Queen Sabria Loren Garrick," Lord Griswold announced loudly. "You are charged with treason against the crown and plotting the murder of your own husband, the dread King of the North. How do you plead?"
Finally, finally. Anise's mother turned her head toward the royal box. But it wasn't Lord Griswold she looked at, but Anise. Anise's breath caught in her lungs, and her heart began to pound out a staccato beat. Her mother's lips opened, and for a moment Anise thought she was going to say something to her. But then she said,
"Guilty."
The crowd cheered, but Anise didn't hear them. Lord Griswold might have smiled, but Anise didn't see anything but her mother's face, which was stoic and resolute, and she mouthed something. Three words that forced tears to Anise's eyes.
"I love you."
Lord Griswold's voice carried over all.
"You are hereby sentenced to death by hanging. Executioner."
The black-garbed executioner descended the steps and moved into position.
"I love you too,"
Anise mouthed, unable to speak the words aloud. Her mother's eyes softened, and a shadow of a smile crossed her lips. It was the happiest she'd ever looked to Anise.
"Now!"
her uncle shouted, and the executioner shoved the platform away. Her mother's body dropped rapidly, bouncing as the rope went taut, jerking her around like a rag doll. Her hands went to her throat, and for several long seconds she fought against the inevitable, her body eventually going still, rocking back and forth gently in the breeze. Tears stung Anise's eyes. Her hands ached from gripping the railing. She whirled around to locate her uncle, but Sejonius blocked her view, his face ashen.
"Don't,"
he warned silently.
Anise wanted to scream in his face, to shove him back.
She wanted to curse his inconsistency and willingness to let this happen. Then she recalled the way her mother had looked at the very end.
Strong. Courageous.
She turned away from him, clinging to her mother's last three words, unspoken but heard by Anise's ears louder than a shout.
"I love you. I love you. I love you."
Down below, a second platform and scaffolding were moved into position. Her mother's body was cut down, covered with a white cloak, and carried off. They hauled her away like a sack of oats. Anise already felt numb, and then Arch and Sir Dietrich were marched onto the platform. All feeling left her body. 6. The Eastern Kingdom, north of Rue, on the road to Feria. Roan. Roan's hind parts had never been so sore, but there was no relief in sight as the horse galloped beneath him. He dared not heel himself, not when it would be too obvious. Worse, he was forced to ride behind one of the prince's men, a thick fellow who rarely spoke, but grunted often and had an aroma that suggested bathing was not part of his normal routine. Then again, Roan knew he probably didn't smell much better. Unfortunately, his life mark could heal wounds, but not body odour. Although he hated to admit it, he'd rather be riding behind Gareth. Or the silver-clad woman. He couldn't decide. They'd been riding pell-mell ever since the messenger brought the news of the Northern King's demise. Roan hadn't been sad to see Baronwood fade away behind them, blotted out by the constant fog that seemed to hang over it like a grey blanket. Now, with each new bruise on his backside, he was hating the eastern plains even more. The terrain was monotonous, the flatland of grass and bush seeming to stretch on to infinity. Somewhere on to the edge of the horizon, Roan thought he could see something glinting in the sun, but he couldn't be certain. "How much further?" he asked, his fingers aching from clutching the thick cantle separating him from the nameless man. Though his hands were still tied, his feet were free, thumping against the horse's ribs on each side. The man turned his head and offered a grunt. Prince Gareth Ironclad's horse, a black stallion that never seemed to tire, pulled up beside them, keeping stride. "Ho, plague child!" Gareth called. Roan pretended not to hear him. "Drowned rat?" Gareth said. Roan could see the prince smiling on the edge of his vision. He pretended to only just hear him. "Did you say something?" he asked. "How are you enjoying the ride?" Gareth asked, slowing his horse's gait to a trot. "Not too sore, are you?" Without being commanded, the rest of his men eased to a halt beside him. "I'm wonderful," Roan said, trying not to grimace as he slung his leg over the horse's back and attempted to slide off. With his hands tied in front, he wasn't able to steady himself, and he ended up sprawling face first into a prickly tuft of grass. The brown mare nuzzled in beside him, munching on the grass. The men laughed, the prince the loudest, his voice carrying over all. "I thought we had a spy, but I'm fairly certain we've got a new court jester," the prince said, much to his men's appreciation. Roan muttered a curse under his breath and managed to push to his feet. Why were the prettiest ones always the most annoying? "What was that, jester? Do you have a jape for us?" Roan did his best to ignore the prince, but it was hard when the young man strode up beside him and clapped him on the back. "Friend, if you tell us the truth about yourself, this will all go much easier." The truth. Roan was so used to everything but the truth that the truth had almost lost all meaning. "The truth is in front of your face," Roan said. "I was afflicted with the plague, sent to Dragon's Breath, somehow recovered, climbed the wall, fought past a dragon, and was swept by current and fate into your snare." "Snare? We were but floating along when we happened upon you, battered and broken and clinging to your dragon's tooth." Gareth patted the fang, which hung from his belt. "We most likely saved your life, spy." "I am no spy." "You are also no jester," the prince said, "despite the fact that you act like one." Roan was tiring of this conversation, so he changed the subject. "Who is she?" He gestured to the green-cloaked woman on the chestnut mare, now just a speck of greenish-brown in the distance. Unlike the rest of them, she hadn't stopped when the prince stopped, continuing her feverish gallop across the plains. The prince tried to hide the grimace, but Roan still noticed it. "So you've noticed her beauty, have you?" Roan couldn't deny her physical appeal, but that wasn't the focus of his inquiry. There was something strange about her. "She's different than us, isn't she?" That response seemed to please the prince. "Ha! What gave her away?
Was it her yellow or cat eyes, or steel-silver hair? She is a forest dweller. Her people have lived in the east long before our Crimean ancestors discovered these lands. The king conscripted her as a scout and a messenger because of her stealth and speed as a rider. Conscripted? You mean enslaved?
Roan's experience with monarchs was that they always got what they wanted.
No, I don't mean that at all. In the east, all men and women are free. She could leave the king's service today if she wanted.
But she won't. My father is generous to those who remain loyal to him, and she is no exception. Roan chewed on this information, trying to decide how much to believe. His estimation of the prince was that he was arrogant to a fault, but not a liar. What he was saying was probably true, which surprised Roan. Could the people under the thumb of a monarch ever really be free? He set the question aside to consider later.
But is she human?
He asked.
He'd heard of strange creatures in the East.
Depends on your definition, the prince said.
Mostly, I'd say. But not as human as you or I. Not as flawed.
What's her name?
Gwendolyn Storm. A strong name for a strong woman, don't you think?
Roan couldn't argue with that, but that wasn't what interested him.
What of her armour? I've never seen anything like it.
Her kind have power over ore. To them, metal isn't a thing. It's part of them, like the air they breathe.
Her kind?
The Aurians.
Roan wished he'd listened more to his guardian's lessons, but at the time, Calypso felt impossibly far from the rest of the Four Kingdoms.
He remembered hearing about the forest dwellers of Auria, but that was the extent of his knowledge.
"Will she wait for us?" he asked.
Already she was the size of a pinprick, a green cloak nearly lost amongst the never-ending plains.
"You're fortunate I'm in a generous mood, or I'd cut out your tongue for asking too many questions," the prince said.
I've instructed her to scout ahead.
Yes, she will wait.
I want to present the good tidings of the Northern King's death to my father personally, though he may have already heard through the streams.
Why do you care about some dead king?
Roan asked.
From his experience with royalty, a dead king meant little. There were always heirs, and a king was easily replaced.
You really don't know much, do you? The prince said.
I know survival, Roan said, remembering the night he ran away from his guardian.
The first few weeks on the streets of Calypso had been the hardest, especially when he refused to eat the scraps of meat occasionally thrown his way, holding out for mouldy bread and cheese discarded by the marketplace vendors.
When you're always searching for your next meal, for your next place to sleep, you care less and lesser about the actions of kings and their offspring.
You talk of us as if we are a curse on the land.
The prince was smiling.
He always seemed to be smiling. A fact Roan grudgingly admitted appealed to him.
If only you knew the half of it, Roan thought.
We are all cursed in our own ways, Roan said.
How jaded you are,
the prince said, tossing him a waterskin.
Anyway, drink your fill and then we ride on.
Roan groaned, wishing his hands could be used to rub his sore ass. Days passed in monotony. Each time the sun set, Roan peered into the distance and swore the glittering something he could see was farther away than when they started out. At least his rear end was beginning to build up enough bruises to make the journey slightly more comfortable. Along the way, Roan remained vigilant, searching for an opportunity to escape. But on the endless plains, where a man on horse or foot could be seen for leagues, he wouldn't get far. So he bided his time, waiting for his chance. When they stopped to sleep, Roan was given food and water, but not enough to satisfy him. Thankfully, they never offered him meat, so he wasn't forced to explain his unwillingness to eat it. In some ways it was humorous watching the prince taunt him with wild game that provided no temptation. He'd also been given a white shirt and brown breeches, as well as a sturdy pair of boots.
"We stole them from a dead man,"
Gareth had said with a smirk. Roan's tattered clothes and shoes were burned in the campfire, and he wondered whether, despite the prince's nonchalance, his story about the plague and dragon's breath had been believed. Probably not. More than likely they were simply taking precautions. While encamped, twice he tried to talk to the forest dweller, hoping to learn more about the origin of her armour, and twice she ignored him, going so far as to walk away to sit by herself. Each time the prince and his men laughed. "Smooth as silk, sir, born from dust," the prince said. "I wasn't trying to be..." Roan started to respond, but then shook his head. There was no point in arguing with Gareth. The third time he spoke to Gwendolyn Storm, she looked right at him, the last dying rays of the eastern sun illuminating her face. In the faux light, her eyes were as golden as the petals of the lumia, a desert flower that grew only in the south's arid climate. The lumia was lovely to look at, but when its petals were ground into a paste, it became a deadly poison if ingested. The look she gave him felt kind of like poison. And then she turned away, saying nothing. "Why does she hate me?" Roan asked Prince Gareth, who was sitting nearby next to the cook fire, which was crackling happily. Roan had his back against a gnarled tree stump. The rest of the tree was gone. "It's not that she hates you," the prince said, and, based on the prince's tone, Roan knew immediately his question wasn't being taken seriously. "It's that she can't stand to bear your ugliness for more than a spare moment." "Now who's the jester?" Roan said. The prince showed his teeth, but didn't laugh. "Sometimes I wonder if that plague of yours ate the small brain you were born with. You're from the south, right?" Roan nodded slowly, wondering where this was going. "I told you. I grew up in Calypso." "You think the East-West War has been going on for a long time?" "Well, compared to our little disagreement, the war between the Calypsians and Aurians is ancient. They've been doing battle for thousands of years, ever since Empress someone or other hatched her first dragon and decided she should rule the entire realm. So, yeah, she hates you." Roan shook his head. His entire life he'd been so focused on surviving another day, getting another bite to eat, that he'd never concerned himself with the broader world. After all, despite what his guardian had taught him as a young child, he would never be a part of anything larger than the dusty city in the south. And yet, here he was, cavorting with Eastern royalty and their allies. "And now a strange but beautiful woman I've never truly met hates me simply because I grew up in Calypso. No wonder the war will never end." "Still, she shouldn't hate me just because of where I'm from. I had no choice in the matter." "Her father was killed in the Battle of Barrenwood," Gareth said. "Oh, but wait. You said that was more than 80 years ago. That doesn't make sense." "I'm feeling more and more like your tutor," the prince said. "The Aurians live for well in excess of 100 years. The oldest has been recorded to have survived to her 195th name day." "Blazes." Roan had no idea. "But that would make Gwendolyn..." He turned toward where she'd gone and found her standing upright, a silhouette against the darkling sky. She appeared to be looking back at him. She seemed to be holding something, pulling on something, aiming at something. "Don't move," Gareth said, as if he had time. Before the second word was out of the prince's mouth, a thin shadow darted from the gloom and sliced through Roan. He cried out, and when he tried to move his arm, he found it tethered to the tree stump. The men were laughing. He looked to the side to find a narrow metal shaft protruding from the wood. He felt no pain, so it had missed him. Barely. But it had caught a loose bit of fabric hanging from his shirt just beneath his armpit. The impact so powerful it had pinned him to the old tree like a trophy on a board. With his opposite arm, he tried to yank the arrow out, but found it impossible. "Need a hand?" the prince said, still chuckling. He snapped his fingers, and two of his men stepped forward, each grasping part of the shaft, leaning back, and, bit by bit, tearing the bolt from the stump. When Roan was free, he leapt to his feet and searched the terrain for Gwendolyn Storm. He spied her hunched form, sitting cross-legged, facing away from them.
"She could have killed me," Roan said, taking a step in her direction.
The prince extended a hand to stop him.
"If she'd wanted to kill you, she would have. That was nothing more than a message."
Roan frowned.
"What message?"
"Stay away from her."
There had to be more to the story of her father's death at Baronwood.
"You said it was the Dreadnoughters who fought your people in the Dead Forest?"
"Actually, I said savages, but I," the prince said, sitting on a rock by the fire.
"But the Calypsians have nothing to do with the Dreadnoughts."
"Yes, they are within the bounds of the realm, but the Sands family does not exercise control over them. So her father's death doesn't explain why she hates me."
There was a sly gleam in Gareth's eye.
"I thought you knew nothing about royal politics."
"I don't, really. Just gossip on the street."
"I said the Dreadnought warriors led the battle, but they weren't the only Southrons there."
Roan frowned. He was sick of missing crucial details. Why hadn't he asked his guardian more questions before he'd left? Clearly the prince was implying something, and there was only one answer that fit.
"The Calypsians?"
Roan tried to picture the royal family tree. The Sand sisters were born of Vin Hosa of Fanes and Sun Sands of Calypso. Before mistrust and deceit ended their marriage and thrust the South into civil war. And Sun Sands had been the eldest of three daughters of Jack and Riza Sands. But neither had been of age 100 years earlier. Who came before them? The answer struck him like a metallic arrow to the brain.
"Roan Sands," he whispered.
The prince nodded. "Gwendolyn's father would have survived if not for the second wave of attack, provided by the Calypsians. Roan Sands was riding a red dragon larger than the trees of Ironwood. They say the beast cooked Baroness Storm alive within his armor. So not only are you from Calypso, but you bear the first name of her father's murderer. Not to mention you claim to be born from dust, which isn't far from Sands. Can you really blame her for remembering the worst day of her life every time she sees you?"
Roan shook his head.
He couldn't blame her. "Just be thankful she sent a message, and not an arrow through your eye." The prince laughed. On the seventh day they reached the place that had been glittering in the sun for days. To Roan's surprise, it was another forest. But Roan had never seen a forest like this. Whereas Baronwood had been dead and dying, the great Ironwood was very much alive. The forest seemed to be in constant motion, growing, changing before his very eyes. Branches stretched and shook out their leaves, which, glinting with metal around the edges, fell across his shoulders. But that was only the start of the curiosities hidden within the bounds of the forest. The trees were sheathed with iron, which formed intricate patterns on their flanks, much like Gwendolyn Storm's armor. Every time the sun peeked through the clouds, the trees glittered as if studded with diamonds, which explained what they'd seen from afar. Metallic arches and platforms swept overhead, and from time to time Roan saw swift-footed creatures racing across them, moving so quickly he never got more than a glimpse. Above the trees, enormous winged birds swooped and soared. Their wings were as silver as the edges of blades.
"What are they?"
Roan asked, watching the silent flyers.
"Awhawks," Gareth said. "Don't get too close to them. They have a fondness for human scalps, and their beaks are even sharper than their talons."
The prince turned away before Roan could read his expression to tell if he was serious. The road was wide and well kept, and as their horses marched through the forest, silvery flowers grew and faded before them.
"This is impossible," Roan said.
"Metal doesn't grow."
"Do your eyes deceive you, then?" a voice said. It wasn't the prince this time, but Gwendolyn Storm,
who was waiting for them beside an enormous tree completely encased in iron. The forest dweller had her hood thrown back, her cat-like eyes boring into Roan. Roan did his best to appear unsurprised that she'd addressed him. "Perhaps it is a dream," he said, dismounting. Gwendolyn snapped a torch from a nearby sconce. In the moment she brought it near her face, something flashed on her cheek. A symbol of some kind, almost like an X, but coming to squares rather than points. She thrust the torch at Roan, and the mark disappeared. "A tattooer," Roan realized. "She's marked, like me." Roan wondered what her mark meant, what power it gave her. "If you are dreaming, then plunge your hand into the flames. It shall not hurt." There was a twinkle in Gwendolyn's eyes, and Roan couldn't tell whether it was because she wanted to watch him burn himself, probably, or if she was merely playing with him like a cat pawing at a trapped mouse, also a distinct possibility. He'd already felt the pain of all-consuming dragon fire, an agony 1,000 times worse than this measly torch. But Roan knew he'd be sorely tempted to heal his burnt hand in front of them. And then his greatest secret would be bared for all to see. As he stared at the flames, he was thankful one of the prince's men had given him a fresh shirt to wear, hiding the life mark on his chest beneath thick folds of fabric. "I will burn myself if you will do the same," Roan said. Gwendolyn blinked. Behind Roan, Prince Gareth chuckled. "This should be entertaining," he said. Roan wondered what he meant, but already Gwendolyn had placed the torch back in its fixture on the tree. A moment later she'd unsheathed a sword half as tall as her. Before Roan's eyes, the sword transformed, the metal curling and twisting, losing its sharp edges. Gwendolyn smiled, and Roan couldn't help but to smile back, transfixed. A moment later he was flat on his back and his entire body felt bruised. She'd moved so fast he'd barely been able to track her with his eyes, much less defend himself. Dazed, he sat up to find her leaning casually against the iron tree. With that, she mounted her horse and left Roan to nurse his wounds. Prince Gareth placed a hand on his shoulder. "Don't worry, friend. It's happened to the best of us, myself included. Now, come. It's time for you to meet the king." As they travelled along the wide road through Ironwood, Prince Gareth never seemed to tire of talking about the land of his ancestors. As they walked and talked, Roan slowly, surreptitiously, healed the bruises caused by Gwendolyn's attack. "In the west, they say we conquered the east," Gareth said. Roan had been told exactly the same thing. In the history he'd been given, the early Crimean settlers who moved eastwards had fought great battles against the natives before claiming the land for their own. Eventually they declared independence from the west, which began the East-West War, an ongoing battle that had raged for hundreds of years. "You're saying the westerners are lying?" Roan scoffed. "They weren't here. Just because they would have ridden to the east with war cries and swords doesn't mean we would. In reality, the east conquered us. My forefathers were beguiled by the beauty of this place and of the forest dwellers who inhabited it. They learned to live with the Aurians rather than against them. Of course, there were those on both sides who caused trouble, and there was occasional bloodshed. But we've had peace since the year 150, when our people began to interbond with the foresters." Interbond. Bonding is what the Aurians call marriage. Most of us have some percentage of Aurian in us these days. "What about Gwendolyn Storm?" Roan asked. "She'd moved like the wind, and she was fate-marked." "Give it up, lad. Forget about her. It'll only bring you pain and us laughs." Although the prince tried to keep his tone light, Roan could feel a sharp spike of anger in it. "Why would that be?" Roan wondered. "Does the prince have a history with the Aurian woman?" "I'm not interested in her like that," Roan said quickly. "Why would he want someone who hated him?" "Because she's beautiful, for one," he thought. "Just like you." He stifled the thoughts. Then you are not a man.
Roan chose to ignore the quip, mostly because it implied the prince would likely never have interest in him.
But she is of mixed heritage, he pressed.
Actually, she is one of the few who are descended from a single culture line. She's full forester. Those like her tend to stick to their own kind, which is why you need to forget about her.
The road curved broadly, the metallic trees standing straight and solid on either side, like sentinels. Metal vines grew down from above, curling around Roan's arms and legs, squeezing and releasing. Roan flinched visibly, and the prince winked at him.
They're only checking you out, deciding whether you're a threat.
And if I am?
You're not,
the prince laughed loudly.
But what if?
They'll wrap around your neck and choke the life out of you, Gareth said casually. He spurred his horse on, and the rest of the men followed behind.
The metal vines lingered on Roan's skin for a few moments longer, before slipping away and rising toward the sky.
He breathed a deep sigh of relief, wondering whether or not he was a threat to the east.
Probably not, he decided. I'm not even supposed to be here.
Up ahead, Gwendolyn Storm was stopped in the center of the path, waiting. She didn't look at them, instead gazing upon a new part of the forest, different than anything Roan had seen so far.
"The Iron City," Gareth said. "My home. Welcome to Faerûr."
Roan stared in awe. If the forest was impossible, Faerûr was whatever came after impossible. Unlike Calypso, where everything was stone and sand and dust, the eastern stronghold was iron intermingled with nature. Roan would have expected an iron city to be cold and hard, but this city was anything but. Each structure was a work of art, the metal forming around enormous trees in beautifully unique ways that even the West's best smiths would find it difficult to imitate if they had 100 years to try. Walls were carved with depictions of tree and critter, sword and shield, banner and horse. The crossed swords of the Eastern Sigil were displayed on each building, etched to perfection. Dwellings were built within hollowed-out trees, so large around that 100 men could stand arm to arm and still not complete a full circle. Each door and window was independently designed as well, some appearing as wisps of smoke and others as falling leaves. Most of the buildings had spires protruding at odd angles, piercing the grey fabric of the sky, giving them a royal feel, as if Roan were approaching a mystical castle. As they entered the forest city, many of the townsfolk stopped to gaze at them. Each of them wore metal of some kind, all of it finely crafted. There was a man with a red-painted metal vest with long, thin tail feathers. A woman had an iron hat with tiny metallic flowers sprouting from the sides. Another waved as they passed, his hands hidden by metal gloves that seemed almost a part of him. The prince greeted each person in kind, many of them personally.
"Ho, Piper Johns! How are the fish biting?" he said to a man with a metal rod and hook. To another, "Aye, Jam Pepper, you are looking vibrant on this grey afternoon."
No one seemed to fear him the way the monarchs of the south were feared. Is it an act, or is it real? Roan wondered. Already he'd seen the way Gwendolyn was treated. She made no effort to hide her mark, and, according to the prince, she was free to come and go as she pleased. For 1/4 of 1 moment, Roan wondered whether this was a place where he could be happy, where he wouldn't have to hide his true self any more, where his gift could help rather than hurt those around him. In the next 3/4 of that same moment, 100 contradictions presented themselves, and Roan knew he was deluding himself. He was the last person who could find peace in the east. At least a furlong into the city, there was a great marketplace, built within a tree as wide as the Southron pyramids. They passed stands billowing aromatic smoke, bearing the scent of broiled hen, smoked trout and lamb stew, amongst others. One stand even had an entire wild boar roasting over an open fire, the spit turning slowly, fat sizzling and dripping into the flames, while street urchins stared longingly at the meat. Roan's stomach turned at the sight of the cooking flesh. At another stand, children were clamouring at the front, flipping iron coins to the seller, and claiming tubs of plum pudding.
"You can eat when you're dead," the prince said, mistaking Roan's interest in the food